Welcome to 7 Things EMS, a continuing education offering from Limmer Education. 7 Things EMS is designed to give you what you need to succeed in EMS. It's conversational, informational, and without the fluff.
And welcome to another 7 Things EMS episode. My name is Dan Limmer, and I am thrilled to have with us for this session, David Pfeiffer. David is an assistant professor at Eastern Kentucky University, the director of the Center for Wilderness and Outdoor Public Safety, and a founding coordinator of Red Star, a wilderness EMS team for his little part of Kentucky right there. Well, his wilderness is probably a big part, isn't it? So I want to welcome you.
Thanks, Glenn. Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Now, I'm gonna say we don't have a lot of fluff here. There's one thing I'm going to tell you, and we talked about this before we started, is that I really don't know a lot about wilderness. For me, wilderness is when the Marriott is full and I have to stay at the Fairfield. Right. That's as close as I've been to wilderness in my life. So I think that with that being said, that I will learn as much from this as anyone that's listening. And I do think it's a topic that's people are really paying attention to. Now, from the certifications that you can get in it to just realizing how different it is.
Yeah, there's a real renaissance happening right now in wilderness EMS. It actually reminds me a little bit of what happened with sort of like tactical and combat medicine, I guess, broadly speaking. Right. Over the past 20 years, it went from being a real niche kind of a thing to being something that's very commonplace. You have TCCC and TECC that are very accessible now, and wilderness EMS is going through something very similar.
Well, I think that leads us right to the first of our 7 things, and which I love what you've done. You've got some concepts here. You've got some clinical here. It comes together really well. Number one is that wilderness medicine and wilderness EMS are distinct things. They're different, it sounds like.
That's right. Wilderness EMS is really a subset of wilderness medicine. So let's start with that. Wilderness medicine is a very broad field, and it includes every kind of wilderness environment that you could think of, from high altitude to low deserts, marine, mountaineering in the Himalayas, jungles, and every climb and environment you can think of. Wilderness medicine is basically about providing medicine in those kinds of places. And so some of the characteristics of wilderness medicine beyond the obvious like wilderness is things like improvisation. So wilderness medicine training sort of classically emphasizes using found materials, using limited resources, and a lot of kind of improvisational kinds of things. And so listeners might have heard of training like wilderness first aid. They might have heard of a wilderness first responder course, or what we call WOOFER. And so these are training courses that are very popular amongst people who spend a lot of time in the outdoors, whether it's Boy Scout troop leaders or rock climbing guides. And certainly plenty of healthcare providers take those kinds of courses as well. The difference between that and wilderness EMS is that wilderness EMS is not about improvisation. Wilderness EMS is about organized delivery of healthcare, just the same as EMS in any other environment. So it's really about systems of care. So wilderness medicine might emphasize how to improvise a splint out of hiking poles or sticks or sleeping pads. You know, wilderness EMS is really more about how do you do safe procedural sedation in the woods to be able to maybe manipulate somebody's extremely painful, angulated, broken leg to be able to put it in, a proper kind of a splint. Wow. And so it's that kind of difference. And if I used an example there, like procedural sedation, that's pretty high end, right? But that's really what wilderness EMS is about. So think about everything that's a part of typical EMS, and now you're basically adapting that into wilderness environment. So there's some overlap there. In wilderness EMS, you basically have what you can carry. So it's limited resources. It is still a ethos, I guess, of a little bit of improvisation. You have to be creative sometimes with the limited supplies that you have. But that's the big distinction there, is basically Wilderness medicine is this very, 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 very broad field. Wilderness EMS is basically, I'm an on-duty paramedic. I'm an on-duty EMT. I'm an on-duty EMS physician. And I now need to respond into a wilderness environment. What are the specialized practices, knowledge, equipment, so forth that I need to bring with me?
And I think that this is going to roll into number two really well. And I think in this one, I think it would be a great time. I know that I see you on Facebook. You know, sometimes your team has been activated, and it's fascinating stuff. Number two is wilderness EMS is more than EMS in the woods. And that might be a great time, if it's something that you can, you know, talk about, to give an example of maybe how it all comes together on top of, you know, talking about why that is.
Yeah, so the procedural sedation example that I just gave came to mind because one of the sort of exemplars of wilderness EMS is a patient that I had a couple of years ago who had dislocated his shoulder in a wilderness area here in Kentucky. So my team, as you mentioned, covers an area called the Red River Gorge. It's a Forest Service property that is world-class rock climbing, backpacking, certainly lots of camping and other kinds of outdoor activities. But we have these big sandstone arches and big soaring cliff lines. We get about 1 million visitors a year, and we stay very, very busy with different kinds of calls. So this was a trail runner who was approximately, I don't know, 1.5, 2 miles out in the woods, not an enormous distance, but the terrain.
You talk about that like, oh, only 1.5, 2 miles, you know.
Well, okay, that's fair. You know, it's I guess it's a matter of perspective. But we, you know, there are many wilderness EMS teams out there who are going miles and, you know, dozens, sometimes hundreds of miles into the wilderness. So, you know, I'm not in the Pacific Northwest with these incredible mountain ranges. And, you know, I'm not in New England where, you know, I have to hike dozens of miles along the Appalachian Trail or something like that to reach somebody. Our distances are fairly small here, but the terrain is very, very challenging, very, very rugged. So 1.5 miles can take a couple of hours because there can be a lot of scrambling up and down rocks and terrain changes and very, very narrow trails that can be incredibly slippery after rain or during snow and ice. And we have to rig rope systems, and it's just very, very challenging terrain. So this was a gentleman who was a trail runner. He was, again, a couple miles out, tripped and dislocated his shoulder. Had a history of shoulder dislocations, and he warned us when we, were helping him. He said, "You're not going to be able to reduce this. We have a shoulder reduction protocol." We said, "Well, you know, we did an informed consent kind of thing, right?" I said, "Well, can we give it a try? We can medicate you for the pain, and we use two or three different techniques, sort of first line, second line, third line reduction techniques." The first couple of attempts, the first couple of techniques, I guess, basically, were just incredibly painful. You know, muscle is spasming. He's just in an enormous amount of pain. Fentanyl is not touching it. We said, well, you know, we can give you a fairly healthy dose of ketamine, and we can, you know, basically disassociate you, you know, not in lay terms, but that's what we're conveying to him. We can disassociate you. I think we can facilitate, you know, putting this back in. Now, the reason that's really important is that, of course, the sooner you put a dislocated shoulder back in, the better the outcome for the patient, the fewer complications, the easier the procedure tends to be. You also run into an evacuation challenge with these kinds of patients. A patient who needs a lot of shoulder support, a big sling and swath with an improvised wedge from a SAM splint, that patient actually is going to have maybe a little bit of a difficult time with some balance and mobility, actually, especially if they're still in a lot of pain. It's really in everybody's interest, the patient and the rescuers, to reduce that shoulder as early as possible. Did give him a disassociative dose of ketamine. And of course, anytime you're using ketamine, you need to have end-tidal CO2 monitoring. You should probably have a couple of liters of oxygen flowing. You need to be prepared for, potential untoward or adverse events, like maybe hypersalivation. So that's wilderness EMS. We're out in the woods, but we still need to achieve end-tidal monitoring. We still need to achieve oxygenation. We still need to have a suction ability ready. So it's not technically procedural sedation, I use that example as probably something a physician, a wilderness EMS physician would probably do, or maybe a physician extender would do. You know, it's not really procedural sedation to give somebody a dissociative dose of ketamine, not technically. But, you know, that's the kind of stuff where in wilderness EMS, you're thinking about doing. That's the kind of situations. And so it's not just quote unquote EMS in the woods, because you can't just sling your life pack on your back and take it out to the patient. You know, you can't just grab your Iron Duck duffel bag and take it out to the patient. You know, my ambulance service carries stat packs, a little bit easier to take out in the woods, but they're packed and set up to be able to open up that stat pack on the floor of a house and, you know, intubate somebody or medicate somebody or do whatever it is. So in wilderness EMS, we're using some specialized equipment, some specialized tools. We're not carrying a fully featured cardiac monitor. We're carrying a small, lightweight 3 or 4 lead ECG device. We're carrying small end tidal monitoring devices called the EMMA capnograph. It's just a tiny device that fits right on a tube, or it can be fitted into a simple face mask to be able to give you your capnometry values and your waveforms. We're typically carrying much higher concentrations of drugs so that we can carry fewer vials, so that we can fit everything we need in our back in a lightweight pack, you know, in a lightweight profile. So it is EMS. We are in the woods, but there's a lot that has to be adapted from standard EMS practices to be safe and effective in that environment. So it's really no different than other specialty forms of EMS in that sense. You know, what works for a typical 911 call does not work in the tactical environment. You're not going to be able to get in, quote unquote, the stack with a bunch of law enforcement officers, you know, just toting your monitor, you know, and your duffel bag. Same way, you know, a paramedic who is trained and oriented to the ambulance environment is probably going to be a little bit out of sorts if you just throw that person on a helicopter. So there is a specialty training for all of those different kinds of specialty practice environments. Wilderness EMS is no different in that sense.
All right, before we get into the number point three, we start to get into some of the clinical stuff, but just sometimes these things just roll. Tell me about the training and the certification that's available. We could do it, you know, I don't want to say briefly, but you doing this is not something that you just started doing. There's training involved in this, I'm sure ongoing training. What got you to where you are right now?
Sure, yeah. So, yeah, I'll talk very briefly about my little journey and then share a little bit about some of the training and certification options that are out there for EMTs and paramedics. I got into the general world of search and rescue as a very, very young boy, really. I joined the Civil Air Patrol when I was about 12 or 13 back in Roanoke, Virginia. And the Civil Air Patrol is the Air Force Auxiliary, similar to the Coast Guard Auxiliary or something like that. And one of their primary missions is search and rescue. So in many parts of the country, when somebody goes missing, especially when an aircraft goes missing in rugged terrain, the Civil Air Patrol is activated and they will be doing the searching. So I joined the local Civil Air Patrol squadron as a cadet when I was, you know, like a young teenager, because my parents knew that I had this interest in public safety and kind of military kinds of stuff. They thought that would be interesting for me. And it was. So I started learning basic search and rescue types of methodology under the guidance of the adult officers in that squadron. And then became an EMT when I was 16 and, you know, fell into that whole volunteer junior squad, you know, kind of thing. Time went by and then I found myself, I graduated from college. I moved to Washington, D.C. And got a request to do some training for a local outdoor organization in wilderness first aid. And I thought to myself, well, I'm a fairly experienced EMS provider. I know about the outdoors. I camp and backpack and hike, and I've done search and rescue. And sure, how difficult could this be to put together this first aid course for them? And what I found was that actually it was a real specialty. And that kind of launched my journey. And then I just immersed myself in it and found that it was something that I was really passionate about. You know, there's paramedics out there that their thing is peds, or their thing is critical care, or their thing is whatever. And for me, wilderness medicine is just my my thing that keeps me kind of grounded and balanced. And I just really, really love it. So I just went deeper and deeper and deeper into that world. And ultimately, I guess that led me to being very involved in creating the WPC certification. So that is Wilderness Paramedic Certified, offered by IBSC, the same organization that offers the FPC, Flight Paramedic, the TPC, Tactical Paramedic Certified, CCPC, Critical Care Paramedic Certified, and CPC, Community Paramedic Certified. So we just created the Wilderness Paramedic Certification Standard basically last year is when it launched. Beyond that, there is all kinds of training that somebody can take if they're interested in this, starting with some of those courses like Wilderness First Aid, Wilderness First Responder, which is about an 80-hour course, but is not a healthcare certification. It's really just sort of exposure to lots of different concepts. Then there are various companies that offer what they might call a Wilderness EMT or Wilderness Paramedic upgrade, where you can go and take a course of whatever length that that company is offering. And, you know, you can sort of put W before your postnominals, although that really does not have any legal recognition in most states. And then the Wilderness Medical Society offers several different kinds of intensive training. So one is called Fellow in the Academy of Wilderness Medicine. Most people spend anywhere between 2 and 5 years pursuing that fellowship, where you take a very deep dive into all the different facets of wilderness medicine, including wilderness EMS. There's also another certification out there called the Diploma in Mountain Medicine. That one is offered by UIAA. That's the organization that has certification standards for like climbing and mountaineering equipment. And that is a lot of technical rescue, a lot of avalanche rescue, crevasse rescue, coupled with medicine. And I could go on. I know you asked me to keep it brief, but there's many, many different kinds of courses that people can take. It is sort of buyer beware because a lot of this space is unregulated. And that's part of the reason that we came up with the WPC credential. It really is designed to be sort of like the FPC of Wilderness EMS.
I just think that was a wonderful addition. I think people that listen to this that say, oh, I want to know about this. I think you just gave them a really good information on different levels and what to do. So I thank you for doing that. And we'll go into the clinical side here. We have several clinical points here, which I really like. Number three, treatment for heat stroke, widely taught incorrectly. And I can think of things about, you know, the skin condition, all kinds of misinformation that's out there. But you're going specifically here, cold water immersion is safe and effective and can be done in the field. Tell us what's incorrect about what we think in that situation.
Yeah, so it is still very commonly taught. It still even shows up in textbooks and PowerPoint slide decks and things like that all over the world, really, that heat stroke is identified by a lack of sweating and that the treatment for heat stroke is something like misting the patient with water and fanning them with your clipboard or fans or something like that, or placing cold packs or ice packs in the axilla and the groin and maybe even behind the neck. That was the way that I was trained as an EMT, as an intermediate, as a paramedic. And again, it is very persistent, very pervasive teaching. Now, this is starting to change because there's been a real emphasis on environmental illness by a number of different kind of major players. In fact, even NHTSA and various other national level EMS groups are starting to really focus a lot on heat illness as an unreported morbidity and mortality burden. And so there's a lot of focus on this over the past couple of years. Practices are starting to change. But for one thing, heat stroke is not identified by skin condition. Heat stroke is identified by basically alterations to central nervous system function. So heat stroke patients very commonly continue to sweat. Classic heat stroke patients, kind of the elderly patients baking in their apartments with poor ventilation during a heat wave, yes, they tend to stop sweating a little bit more often, I guess, than an exertional heat stroke patient. So a classic heat stroke patient is going to typically progress through, I'm getting hotter and hotter and hotter, I'm getting dehydrated, and maybe I stop sweating. an exertional heat stroke patient can suffer heat stroke almost immediately. It really does not take, I wouldn't say instantaneously, but it does not take a whole lot to be working out in the heat or playing sports in the heat or hiking in the heat and very quickly start to get overheated and actually progress into heat stroke. It's actually quite easy to do. And so these patients are going to be typically very sweaty. And so it's not skin condition. It is that altered CNS function, whether that is loss of consciousness, ataxia, slurred speech, seizures, profound agitation, CNS dysfunction. That is the cardinal sign of heat stroke. And then that teaching about, you know, misting and fanning and cold packs, none of it is effective enough to rapidly bring down their body temperature. And that is the key. The key to survival of the patient in heat stroke is rapid reduction of their core temperature down to about 102 degrees. So for one thing, to be able to really diagnose and treat heat stroke properly, you really do need to be taking rectal temperatures. And so that's the ideal, is to be able to do that. But if you can't do that, you're going to basically cool the patient until their CNS dysfunction is resolved. And to do that, the treatment is cold water immersion. This is the gold standard of heat stroke treatment as practiced by sports medicine experts and most emergency medicine experts. And this literally involves submersion, not up past the airway, but basically water up to basically the neckline. So I guess immersion, not submersion, cold water immersion in ice water. All right. So we're talking about 36 degrees or so ice water. Okay. So at major sporting events, like major marathons, during military training at major military bases, they're going to have pre-chilled cold water ice tanks. And that is the treatment for heat stroke. So how do we do this in the field? Well, there's a lot of different ways to do this. If you look at the social media of Austin Travis County EMS down in Texas, they have multiple posts over the years of them doing successful, CWI, cold water immersion. They've done things like in shopping centers where they've located some of these patients, grab a shopping cart, spread a tarp off the ambulance. So you'd have to be carrying a tarp, spread a tarp or a mega mover or something like that in the shopping cart. They put the patient in the shopping cart, they run to the nearest restaurant, and they've said, we need all the ice that you can give us. And they fill up that shopping cart with ice and water, and they have actually saved multiple lives doing things like that. You can do the same thing in a body bag. Pull the body bag out, put the patient in it, fill it up with ice water. Now you may not have
a restaurant. When they come around, they're a little scared.
Yeah, don't zip the body bag all the way up. That freaks everybody out. But that is a valid technique. Another technique is in collaboration with the fire department. Imagine essentially a code heat response that's going to trigger a couple of fire engines responding. You're going to very quickly put down three ladders in a triangle configuration, lash them together with a little bit of webbing real quick so they don't tip over, spread a salvage tarp down in between that to make a little basin, put your patient in it. Those coolers of ice water that the firefighters keep on their trucks in hot weather for rehab, you're going to dump those in that basin. You're going to put a little water off the truck or out of a hydrant in there. We're going to stir it around. Now we have a cold water immersion basin wherever we need it. There's a technique called TACO, tarp assisted cooling with oscillation. We're going to roll up the edges of a tarp and put a patient in it almost like a hammock. We're going to add ice water to that. So of course, the challenge there is where to get the ice from. But that's going to be very specific to where you're practicing, where you're running, the community that you're operating in, all that kind of stuff. There's a few different ways to probably skin that cat. The bad news in the wilderness is this is probably impossible, right? The best prevention for heat stroke in the wilderness is prevention of overheating to begin with. It's very similar to something like a cardiac arrest kind of a situation way out in the wilderness. If it happens, it's probably not going to have a favorable outcome. So it is very, very difficult in true wilderness environments. But as far as general EMS care, it is actually very achievable.
I think people are hesitant about overcooling, or I've heard other things about that. And they shouldn't be worried about that. The cooling is the thing. And if you don't have rectal temperature, till the central nervous system starts working again, this is really fair game.
It is. And so it's important to point out, overcooling the patient is not great. That's not a great thing to do. But it's not something that I'm going to worry about, in the sense of, if I can't take a core temperature, it's not going to stop me from cooling that patient, because hypothermia is much more survivable than hyperthermia. Hyperthermia has a massively high mortality rate, both initially itself, and then actually within the basically two-year survivability window, the two-year outcome window. People who survive heat stroke actually have a very high mortality rate about 2 years out as well. There's a lot of disability and a lot of morbidity that comes along with heat stroke. It's a real killer. Hypothermia certainly can also kill you. But we know that hypothermia is neuroprotective. It reduces metabolic oxygen demand. It reduces cerebral oxygen demand. That's why there's still some interest in targeted temperature management in some healthcare systems, after cardiac arrest. That's why there's these extensively documented case reports of people being submerged in ice water and surviving, especially after high quality CPR for, sometimes submerged for 30, 45 minutes and they are rescued. High quality CPR is provided and they survive with fairly good neurological outcomes. And so hypothermia is in general better for you, or I would say less injurious to you than heat stroke. So if you're cooling somebody during heat stroke, you really want to cool them down to about 102.5 or 102 degrees and then stop there. But if you overshoot that, either because you just overshot it or you don't have that core temp monitoring, let's say that the patient starts shivering. That's not going to generate enough endogenous heat production to skyrocket their temperature back up to the heat stroke danger zone. People don't start shivering until they're basically, beyond just being like super cold and I have goosebumps, I'm shivering. Shivering is typically associated with basically mild hypothermia. So if they're in mild hypothermia, they're not in danger of heat stroke. So the shivering is not really a big issue. There's no real evidence. It's a myth that it's going to cause some sort of like shock state for their vasculature to constrict down or anything like that. All those things are really myths and they've been disproven. So yes, we want to try to stop the cooling at about 102.5 or 102 degrees core temp. But if we overshoot that, that's not the worst thing that could happen to that patient. The worst thing that could happen to that patient is if nobody treats their heat stroke.
All right. I like it. Now, we talked about a few, misconceptions and some other things about heat stroke. But I'm looking at number four, and if I can think of number four, if I can think of something that has more weird things that people do, it's going to be about envenomations.
Yeah.
Number four, in the U.S., snake envenomations typically don't need many pre-hospital interventions, but there are major do's and don'ts, and I'm guessing your do's and don'ts are going to address a lot of those weird things people think about envenomations.
Yeah. And if I can, I'll touch real quick on, we're both educators. I'll touch real quick on basically cultural sensitivity in the classroom and the whole safe space of learning kind of an issue, which I think some people, ballyhoo and misunderstand. But this is actually very relevant to this issue. Okay. So snake bites. First of all, we should narrow this to North America. I'm sure you have international listeners, but when you start traveling around the world, there's all kinds of snakes. there's all kinds of envenomating creatures and all kinds of stuff. But I would venture to say, I think probably the majority of your listeners and the majority of the users of your textbook and so forth are probably here in the United States. And so generally speaking, what we see, what we're most concerned about with snakes in the United States is the crotalid snakes, the pit vipers. There are elapid snakes, so like coral snakes and those kinds of you can think of a little bit more tropical kinds of snakes. Those do exist in Florida and the Gulf of Texas and the Southwest and things like that. But, for the most part, the burden, I guess, of envenomation tends to be pit vipers. So copperheads and rattlesnakes and those kinds of snakes. And there's a saying in wilderness medicine, the best treatment for a snake bite is your car keys. In other words, go to the hospital. So what this really reminds us of is that, sort of definitive treatment for a snake envenomation is antivenom. And so for crotalids, so pit vipers and rattlesnakes, we have the most common one is called Crofab, the most common antivenom. And it is fairly widely accessible in the United States healthcare system. Not every hospital carries it, but your major medical centers are typically going to have it. Hospitals in areas where there is a high incidence of snakes are typically going to carry it. And, you know, if somebody who has been envenomated goes to the hospital and the envenomation is serious enough to warrant antivenom, then they're going to get it. And typically the prognosis is very good. And so there's a couple of caveats to that. You really want that treatment being provided by a real expert in snake envenomations, which is not necessarily going to be an emergency medicine physician. It might be a toxicologist. It might be an intensivist. It might be somebody else like that. So it does require some subject matter expertise. Okay. So if we back up to the pre-hospital environment, there's a lot of don'ts. Okay. Don't put a tourniquet or any sort of constricting band on a crotalid envenomation. For elapids, there is controversy about whether or not to provide what's called a constricting wrap. And this is a wrap that is basically wrapped proximal to distal. So basically the opposite of how you typically wrap up something like a fracture. So we're trying to basically keep that elapid venom from spreading up the limb. And there's controversy about that. It's questionable whether or not that is necessary or appropriate with traditional transport times and that kind of stuff, and whether or not it can even be done always safely and effectively without a great deal of training. But for the crotalids, right? So again, the copperheads and the rattlesnakes and that kind of stuff, don't put any sort of constricting band on it. No tourniquets, no ACE wraps, anything like that, because all you're going to do then is trap that venom in the compartment that you've created right above that envenomation. And that venom from those snakes tends to break down tissue, tends to break down blood vessels and vasculature, tends to cause a lot of edema. And all you're going to do is just dramatically increase that damage in that space that you have basically cut off beneath that tourniquet and trap that venom. Okay, so nothing constricting. No ice for the same reason. Now we get into things that... this is where we have to be a little bit more careful about sometimes the audience. Cutting and sucking. Outdoor stores still sometimes will sell these snake bite extractor kits where you basically put this suction syringe. It almost reminds me of that old esophageal suction detector device, a big suction device over the envenomation site and suck out the venom. That's not going to work. It's not going to help. It's mostly just going to cause, if anything, it's going to do basically destruction to local tissue. Okay, so they don't work. Now, I brought this up in a wilderness first aid class I taught once, and the audience in that class happened to be primarily from the Pakistan, Bangladesh, northern India kind of region. This was a group of graduate students from a local university who were all biology students, essentially here in the United States on a scholarship to come study at a local university. And we are going over wilderness medicine stuff. We're talking about this. And I kind of, without thinking a whole lot, I guess, I just said, man, I don't know where these myths really come from. You know, why would you suck out the venom from a wound? And one of those students raised their hand. They said, this is widely taught where we come from because we don't have a highly developed healthcare infrastructure. We don't have ambulance services. We can't just go to the hospital and get antivenom. You're taking for granted that these are things that are available to people here in the United States, in our part of the country, or I'm sorry, our part of the world. We're going to do whatever we think we can do to try to buy some time because it's going to be days before any sort of organized medical care is available to us or comes to us. So if we think that we can suck out some venom real quick, we're going to suck it out. That's where that teaching comes from. And everybody in the room nodded. You know, and so I think it was just a very sort of like culturally arrogant kind of a moment for me where I was speaking from that perspective of, an American paramedic who's always been able to assume we can get our patient to the hospital quickly, either by hiking or hoisting or ambulance transport. And there's going to be, experts and poison control center and we'll get the crow fab. And many places in the world, that is not a given. So I think that's a reminder to be sort of humble, I guess, or the way that we teach, we need to not assume that everybody's coming from the exact same background. I'd say the last don't to do, or the last don't for the snake bites is avoid NSAIDs. Those can interfere with clotting factors. So we know this generally about NSAIDs. But when that crotalid venom is injected, you know, that is one of its principal effects, is basically anticoagulation, right? It's almost like rat poison, right? It's designed to help that snake digest its little meal. And so it tends to break down vasculature and interfere with clotting and so forth on its own. Add NSAIDs on top of that for analgesia, and we're just going to make those kinds of situations much worse. So here's what we can do for these patients. One of the most important things is to mark the progression of swelling, pain, and tenderness directly on the skin. So you're going to look at that envenomation site. It's typically going to be fairly obvious with two little puncture wounds from the two fangs, maybe a little bit of bleeding from those. And there's oftentimes going to be redness and swelling right at that localized area. Now, it's worth pointing out that anywhere between about 25 and 40%, depending on the sources you read, anywhere between about, roughly a third to maybe a little bit more than a third of snake bites are what we call dry bites, where there's no venom really injected whatsoever. But many times there is, of course, going to be venom injected. And so you're looking for, that sort of like a redness and a little bit of swelling and so forth, right? That bite site to basically indicate that venom has really been injected. So you're going to take a marker, just a magic marker, and trace the kind of border of that initial redness and that you see and that swelling that you see. And you're going to literally just trace it like almost think of like a color by numbers kind of a painting, right? So if you have this big splotch of redness, just go ahead and trace around it and write directly on the skin, basically swelling. And as we're recording this, it's approximately 11 o'clock Eastern time where I am. And so I would write S11 a.m. And then I would ask my patient to point to where it hurts and where they put their finger for the pain. I would draw another margin or another border, and I would write P 11 a.m. And then I would take my finger and I would elicit tenderness, right? So take your finger and kind of press and trace down again, proximal to distal, and where that patient says, oh, that's a little bit tender, you're going to write T 11 o'clock. So you might have redness right around the puncture site of the envenomation. You might have pain a few inches above that. You might have tenderness a few inches above that. And the tenderness is the extent of the venom spread at that point. So I might have two puncture wounds right on my foot, but if I have tenderness up at my knee, then that is where the venom has already progressed to. So we're going to trace the pain, tenderness, and swelling with timestamps literally right on the skin. And we're going to repeat that assessment about Q15. And that's a really, really important thing to do for the attending physician or the treating physician at the hospital to be able to really see the extent of the venom progression, because that is going to be one of the key drivers of the antidote administration, how much, how aggressive, and when they actually give that treatment. Beyond that, it's really going to be basically supportive care. If you're an ALS provider and your patient is in a tremendous amount of pain, give them some fentanyl, give them some ketamine. If they're nauseated, give them some antiemetics. If you start to see those sorts of systemic symptoms, like significant nausea, significant cramping in core muscle groups, difficulty breathing, basically be prepared to treat those things as you would in essentially any other setting. So if it appears as though they're having an allergic reaction or anaphylaxis, treat the anaphylaxis. If it appears they're having difficulty breathing and they need some assistance breathing, be prepared to assist them with maybe a bag valve mask. So essentially, again, that sort of general care for that symptomology that you might see in general, plus some supportive care. But that's basically how we want to approach snake bites.
Awesome. That was really detailed and fascinating, to do. Let's jump into number five to keep moving. Black widow envenomation. Apparently, calcium gluconate has been taught little evidence of benefit. There are better treatments for black widow envenomation. And everybody's got a picture of the black widow in their book. Yeah. You worry about the black widow. You see pictures on Facebook. Is this the black widow spider? Mm-hmm. It sounds like there is some misinformation out there.
Yeah, it's the black widow is pretty easy to identify. It's that, black spider looks super scary, has a big sort of bulbous body with a red sort of like hourglass shape on it. One of the ironies of me being super into wilderness mess and wilderness EMS is I hate creepy crawlies. I am not an insect guy. They freak me out. Anything with more than four limbs, basically, I have a major, major problem with. And so I have to look at a lot of large, high-res images of spiders and centipedes and that kind of stuff to build, you know, PowerPoints and slides and education. And I hate it. It makes me nauseated. Right. So
snakes don't.
No, I got no problem with snakes. I think snakes are very, very cool. Yeah. I have no issue with snakes at all. In fact, I had the privilege of teaching a wilderness medicine course in Australia a few years ago. And, you know, here we don't have a whole lot of, super scary snakes. But we do have, I think, in my opinion, we have some, you know, scary enough spiders. You know, none that tend to be immediately sort of deadly, but, you know, the black widows and the brown recluses and, you know, a couple of spiders that can really kind of hurt you. Now, over in Australia, they certainly have a lot of very scary spiders as well, but they have more very, very scary snakes that can also really kill you very quickly. So we're teaching this wilderness medicine course. A local snake and insect kind of guy comes in as a guest lecturer, and he brings his specimens of stuff. So I'm sitting in the front row, and he brings in the snakes, and I got no problem with this. I'm into it. The class is they're like backing up. You know, these are like Australian healthcare providers, and they're sort of like, whoa, like too many snakes, right? I got no problem with this. Then he brings in the spiders, and the students are like getting close to the little spider, you know, terrarium to like look at it. They're like, oh, it's beautiful. I'm out of there. I'm out of the room. I can't handle it. I'm sweating. I'm lightheaded. All right. So differences in perspectives about what the real threats are, I guess. But anyway, so the irony of this is I do not like a lot of these insects that we have to deal with. Right. And black widows are certainly on that. It's a real nasty looking, you know, spider, real scary looking. Well, for a long time, there was this prevalent teaching that you would give calcium gluconate to a black widow envenomation because they tend to cause really severe muscle cramping, especially abdominal muscle cramping. It can be very, 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 very painful, very intense. There is, you know, some fear that it could cause like diaphragmatic paralysis and intercostal spasming and make it difficult to breathe. And the idea behind giving the calcium gluconate was, you know, giving calcium as kind of a smooth muscle relaxing kind of an agent to oppose some of that muscular spasming. It turns out that doesn't work that well, right? So these days, the teaching is really probably more so that something like benzos would be more appropriate to help kind of relax a lot of that spasming and discomfort from that black widow bite. So there's not a great deal of literature on this, and I wouldn't say that it is definitive, but the calcium gluconate has really fallen out of favor. It still turns up in a lot of textbooks. That's why I kind of put on this list. When I took National Registry, now this was going on probably more than 15 years ago when I took National Registry paramedic, I did get a calcium gluconate black widow envenomation question. I don't know if that is still on the National Registry. I'd be surprised actually if it is, but it kind of shows you the recency of some of this teaching, it's still out there. So yeah, there's other treatments that are being recommended these days, benzos among them.
All right. Number six, moving along, rigid collars and backboards have no therapeutic role at all. I mean, you made that pretty at all in wilderness EMS. There's better techniques. I can certainly imagine you talk about things that you have to carry around with you. I'm thinking a backboard is probably not at the top of the list.
You know, it's not, but actually, you'd maybe be surprised that it's not as hard as you might think to tote some of that kind of stuff into the wilderness. So the typical response posture that you'll see, a response mode that you'll see in a lot of communities that have well-developed wilderness EMS and search and rescue systems, is at some point, somebody is going to be carrying in like basically a wheeled litter or a helicopter is coming in via hoist, or a UTV type of vehicle is going to come in at some point. And so, you know, there's going to be some sort of like litter that you're going to place the patient in a lot of times to carry them out. And so, you know, throwing a backboard in that litter is not that big of a deal. And they make folding backboards and stuff like that. Well, the reason that I say there is no therapeutic role at all, that statement that I am making reflects the clinical practice guidelines of the Wilderness Medical Society. The Wilderness Medical Society is a very, very evidence-based group of people, dominated sort of by physicians, but there's lots of paramedics, nurses, PAs, all kinds of people involved. They have a very rigorous and strict peer review process for publishing their CPGs. It is the position of the Wilderness Medical Society that there is, quote, no requisite role for rigid collars or backboards in the wilderness. Now, that does not mean that we don't need to still worry about spinal therapy. It absolutely is still important. And that's a distinction that's lost on, I think, some people in the quote-unquote front country setting as well. I think most of your listeners know that there's been a big shift away from rigid spine boards. And there is a shift that is starting to move away from rigid collars as well. But the move away from backboards, I think, is pretty much a standard of care, actually, at this point for most parts of the country. That doesn't mean that we're going to like just toss our patients around, you know, like a rag doll. There's just better, more therapeutic ways to care for their spine. In the wilderness, everything that we know to be harmful about backboards is basically amplified. A lot of the harm from backboards is associated with being on a backboard for greater than about 20 minutes. And that's almost going to be inherent to any sort of wilderness response, right? These are typically long duration kinds of responses. So the decubitus ulcers, the lack of ergonomics and lack of sort of anatomical friendliness, pulling open clots, distracting vertebrae, you know, all that kind of stuff. The maybe even decreases in tidal volume from spider straps and X straps and things like that that are too tight. All of that is just going to become worse and worse and worse, you know, during basically like a multi-hour wilderness rescue scenario. Rigid collars really don't have a whole lot of evidence in their favor either. You know, the ones that we use in EMS tend not to be that great. You know, patients still get discharged from hospitals with, C collars. That's common. But these tend to be very, like, generously padded, very specifically ergonomically molded, you know, very kind of high-end collars. That's not what we're carrying in EMS, right? We're carrying, like, maybe a one-size-fits-all, maybe adjustable. You know, there's different versions out there, but none of them are really that patient-friendly.
And we don't always use them well. We don't sometimes measure right. them or use them well either.
There's a lot of literature out there that they tend to be sized very poorly, and they tend to either, you know, distract or extend or flex or whatever the neck when we don't want it to. So in Wilderness EMS, we really favor soft collars. Collars that can be molded a little bit more to the patient's anatomy, collars that are not going to distract cervical vertebrae apart because they're sized too big, collars that are not going to maybe make the patient feel nauseated because that collar is pressing up against their salivary glands. So soft collars is what we favor in Wilderness EMS. And then instead of the backboard, we would be using something like a orthopedic stretcher, aka scoop stretcher, or better yet, what is really the gold standard of care for spinal therapy, a full body vacuum mattress splint. That is really the ideal device. Yes, they can be taken into the wilderness. Yes, they're very, very effective in that setting. They have a temperature management kind of a benefit to them. You can mold them to the patient instead of pulling the patient into them as you would have to with a backboard. They're great devices. So yeah, we're not using rigid collars. We're not using backboards. We're using things like vacuum mattress splints or scoop stretchers. And then my agency carries basically a malleable C-collar. So think of like the same material as a SAM splint, except it is an actual C-collar. It is, you know, kind of laser cut basically in that shape that people would recognize as being a C-collar. But the benefit of that is that we don't have to move the patient's head and neck around to make them fit into the collar. We're just going to mold it to their contours. It's much more comfortable. If they start to say that they're feeling a little nauseated or there's too much pressure here and there, we can just mold it away from them a little bit. And if we're not going to use that kind of a device, we're just going to basically improvise a soft collar by rolling blankets or towels or things of that nature, or jackets even, into a collar. And there's actually a specific way to do that. There's a good study published by the Wilderness Medical Society a couple of years ago about how to specifically roll something like a fleece jacket into an effective C-collar.
Wow. Well, we're getting pretty much hitting the time limit here. And I have one more to do. But let me just, I'll just say, as I switch, I hope that some of the things that you do in Wilderness and some of the things you have come out to others in EMS. It sounds very cool.
Yeah.
And the last one. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think that's happening. And so, I think we talked a little while ago about, there's like a renaissance that happened with tactical and combat medicine, you know, motivated a lot by the war on terror, but also, unfortunately, these mass shooting events and things of that nature that seem to plague us, where, you know, we went from tourniquets being a last resort. And if you put on a tourniquet, you're going to lose your leg. That's how I was still trained in 2001 when I became an EMT. And now, you know, we now understand very widely in EMS that is not the case, and tourniquets are life-saving and, you know, not something to be scared of and so forth. So military medicine, you know, influenced civilian practices, and that's just one example. And the examples that are actually, you know, countless almost. Wilderness medicine, as we see WPC become more popular, as more people get into wilderness training, you're starting to see an influence from wilderness medicine on the civilian EMS in a similar way. It's not necessarily dramatic right now, but I think it actually will become more dramatic over the next few years as people start to realize, you know, a lot of these things, if we're going to do them for somebody who's in the wilderness because of issues like comfort and efficacy and best use of resources, well, why wouldn't we just do them for every patient? So I think, again, there's sort of we're at the beginning of a little bit of a renaissance in wilderness medicine that's going to influence traditional EMS as well. It's pretty exciting to see.
Yeah. Well, at number 7, the incident command system, competency, it's part and parcel to wilderness EMS. I mean, you've talked about hoisting people out and things you have to do to coordinate. I imagine incident command is really a big part of the overall picture of being successful with such a demanding situation.
Yeah, that's right. Now, I'm a little bit of a foot stomper about this for a couple of reasons. I have a whole parallel career in emergency management. So I am very active on the EM side, not emergency medicine, but on the emergency management side, in addition to EMS. And so I do disaster deployments for the federal government. I'm involved with some efforts here in the state on ICS development. I'm passionate about that in the same kind of way I'm passionate about wilderness medicine. It's just something that I started getting real nerdy about, you know, several years ago. And so, I started getting into EMS education. And, you know, typically the ICS and mass casualty chapters tend to come at the end of most of the textbooks. And that probably makes sense as far as the way that we package all the information for an EMT. But I think a lot of instructors tend to give it short shrift. You get to the end of the class, everybody's focused on registry testing, and you've been drinking from a fire hose, you know, for weeks and weeks and weeks. And this sort of esoteric world of NIMS and ICS comes up. And a lot of people, quite frankly, don't have a whole lot of experience applying it because major mass casualty incidents and disaster responses are not everyday occurrences. So maybe the instructor is not totally comfortable with the subject matter themselves. Maybe it's hard to make it relatable to the student. And so it tends to kind of get short shrift. And, you know, some instructors will just say, well, just go take IS 100, 200, 700, 800, and that'll be fine. And so there's, I think, in my opinion, not a high level of understanding of ICS utilization within EMS, broadly speaking. Certainly, there are some agencies that do it really well, and they use it on a daily basis, and they have a lot of experience responding to major incidents, but I don't think that's common. So now we get into wilderness EMS. ICS is part and parcel to wilderness EMS. Wilderness rescue responses tend to be multi-jurisdictional. They tend to be extended duration. They tend to involve a lot of personnel. They tend to involve a lot of logistical needs, a lot of communications needs, a lot of interface between ground crews and helicopter crews and boat crews. ICS is what you need to use to do that well and to do that safely. And all of those principles of ICS that maybe people learned about, but they don't really do every day, like unity of command. Who do I take my direction from and who do I give my direction to? Being able to build an actual ICS tree. Who is my operations section chief? Who's my logistics section chief? In other words, who is responsible for getting more water? It's 90 degrees out here in Kentucky. We're on an August, you know, wilderness rescue response. We're all sweating to death and there's real environmental hazards to the rescuers. Who is going to be getting that water? Who's going to be getting those cooling fans back at the command post for when we all get out of there? Do I have a medical unit who's basically responsible for the care of the other responders? That kind of thing. That's all ICS. And that stuff is really very important for doing wilderness rescue and wilderness EMS well. So I would say if people are interested in this subject matter, they want to get into wilderness EMS as a real specialty, also make sure you're getting into ICS because it's really part and parcel.
Wow. All right. We get to the end here and I always give everyone a chance for a last word. If you had a message you want to give, if you wanted to wrap this up in a sentence or a paragraph, what's the David Pfeiffer last word on wilderness EMS?
Well, it's two last words, but they're kind of related. The first is there are specialty certifications and specialty training to get for this. It's not a cloistered community. It's not an elitist kind of a thing. It's not anything like that. It's just that you need to have some specialized training. EMS prides itself on we can treat any patient anywhere. And that's what our training model really kind of reflects, right? But it's not really totally true. Yeah, we can go over an embankment to pull somebody out of a car. We can go into the woods to find somebody who's suffering from hypothermia or whatever to an extent. But when you get into anything kind of beyond that kind of basic, you know, kind of all hazards kind of response, you're talking rope rescue, you're talking helicopter operations, you're talking specialized knowledge, specialized equipment. You got to get some specialized training in this stuff. So that's really the first thing I would say. But that kind of is related to my second last little point, which is that EMS is really cool. It's really exciting. And there's a lot of different things you can do and a lot of different places you can do it. And I think right now in our profession, there's a lot of focus on the shortcomings of EMS and the flaws in EMS. And I am one of the critics of EMS. I think we have quite a bit of work to do on building a vibrant, sustainable, healthy, career-oriented field. I make no bones about that. But that doesn't mean that this isn't still really exciting, really fulfilling, really meaningful, really exciting stuff. And there is wilderness and tactical and flight and critical care and special event medicine and peds. And you can pick a thing that interests you, something that you really want to become a real expert in, and you can sort of take it all the way. And it might be a matter of finding the agency to work for that will validate that and let you use those skills. It might be a matter of even moving to places where those kinds of responses or that kind of work is more common. But that's no different than any other career where you sort of have to just find the employer and find the market that is the best fit for your needs. But, you know, wilderness EMS, I think, is representative of how EMS can be really, really cool and really exciting and really fulfilling. It does not have to simply be you call, we haul, rinse and repeat for your entire career. There's lots of specializations to get into.
You say that you're a critic of EMS, but you're a constructive critic. I've seen some of your presentations at national conferences. I think we need that voice. And I think the voice that you've given here over this past hour really gives people a pretty broad idea about wilderness EMS, from concepts to treatment to examples, and then wrapping it up with the ICS and even this message at the end. I think you've really given people an invitation to not only explore wilderness EMS, but to explore EMS. I think it was really solid advice at the end to do that. It's a very positive message, and we do need those. So I want to thank you very much, David Pfeiffer, Assistant Professor, Eastern Kentucky, founder and coordinator of the Red Star Wilderness EMS team, for taking this time with us today. It's just a great show.
Well, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it. Big fan of you and your work and your products. We make extensive use of the whole LIMRA ecosystem here at EKU, and it really helps our students get their arms around this stuff. So thanks for everything you've done for our profession.
Very kind. Thank you. All right. That's another Seven Things EMS episode. And we'll be back next month with another. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for listening to a Seven Things EMS podcast by LIMRA Education. If you've listened to this podcast on a streaming service and you're interested in getting continuing education credit, please go to lc-ready.com for more information.